So on the front of your bulletin is a picture of two men at an event about 18 months ago, November of 2015. And I posted the 15-minute video from which this clip is taken on our backstory last Thursday. Any of you have a chance to watch that, sit through all of that? Yeah, I've listened to it like three or four times. The man on your left, or the man in the left of the frame there, is a Pastor Tabidi Anyabwile. Was a Muslim, became a Christian, now is the pastor of a Baptist community in South D.C. called Anacostia River. The guy on the right is a person we've named to you before. His name is Ta-Nehisi Coates. You have to practice pronouncing his name. I always have to remember, how do you spell that and how does it sound? But his name is Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's a journalist. He's an author. He writes for The Atlantic. And they sat down 18 months ago and talked about, as two black men, the phenomenon of mass incarceration of black men in America. They come from vastly different perspectives. Ta-Nehisi Coates is an atheist and makes no bones about that and is happy to concede that. And not to revel in it, not to boast about it, but just to acknowledge it. Whereas, obviously, Tabidi Anyabwile is a pastor. And so they come from vastly different outlooks on when it comes to hope and the idea of justice. But they do share a common lament about what appears to be a gross imbalance of the application of justice among some constituencies in our country. They also share a common lament about how it seems that so many turn a blind eye to it. They both come from backgrounds in which they probably heard on more than one occasion, on more than one sermon, a quote from a Unitarian minister of all people, Theodore Parker, who said, "The arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice." You probably heard that and you thought Martin Luther King Jr. said it. He didn't. He quoted it from somebody else. They both hear that. That phrase is an organizing principle for many in the black community, from both of these two guys. But whereas Tabidi Anyabwile believes in an eternal justice that fuels his desire to work for justice, even if that arc bends just a little bit in his lifetime, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates who doesn't have much optimism for that arc ever really bending, and therefore listens to a phrase like that from Theodore Parker and thinks, yeah, I don't think so. And that's why what fuels him is not really a belief that the arc of justice will really bend, or the arc of history will bend toward justice. It's more, he's fueled by the desire of not being among the people that want to push society over the precipice, as he puts it. That's where they're coming from. They know that in this country and around the world, if you use the word justice, you immediately invoke and evoke memories, if not the experience of the absolute absence thereof. If you are just joining us, we are in a series during Lent where we are listening to the preacher of Ecclesiastes, who some might say he's a rabble-rouser, a contrarian, somebody that just likes to be ornery, but he's just calling him like he sees him. And as he does so, he challenges a lot of assumptions that people like to make, especially people that call themselves godly. And he, as we've tried to style him, is one out to disabuse us of certain presuppositions, of trying to come at the things that we think are absolutely true and unassailable. And he would say, are you sure? The question at hand today is the God who calls himself just, does he really give us a reason to believe that justice will prevail on the earth? If you were to put Anyabwile and Coates on a spectrum, you might say that the preacher of Ecclesiastes kind of lives somewhere in between their worlds. He's a believer in God. He's a believer in the God who calls himself just, but he is not quite as optimistic as somebody like Anyabwile and might perhaps find more common cause with somebody like Coates. What he offers us today is an unpleasant experience. And I've used this word among you before, but if I walked over to Robin's piano there and I pushed F and F sharp at the same time, you hear this thing, what's called in music terms, a dissonant chord. Dissonance. It grates at your soul. It's like pulling your fingernails down a chalkboard. It's like putting your finger next to sandpaper and rubbing off the edges. It's that unpleasant feeling where two ideas collide. Among psychologists, it's called cognitive dissonance, but don't be impressed by the phrase. But when it comes to talking about justice, you can't talk about justice until you start talking about injustice. And so where justice and injustice go together, you've got the unpleasant experience of dissonance. And the preacher isn't really going to help. What he's going to do for us is three things in what we're going to listen to today. He's going to kind of put his finger into that dissonance. He's going to explore it with us. He's going to probe it. And then secondly, he's going to try to find ways to lessen it. Lessen it, to use a legal term, to mitigate it. But thirdly, he does something interesting. And this will be so metaphorical and abstract, don't worry, I'll explain it. He's going to open a space that might actually hint at a resolution to the dissonance. Don't worry, I'll come out of the ether there for a minute in the third point. But that's what he's going to do. He's going to probe the dissonance, he's going to try to lessen the dissonance, and then he's going to try to open up some room, create a space that dissonance might actually be resolved. We're coming at a topic today that's thematic within Ecclesiastes, so we're going to kind of bounce around to where he talks about this at length. We're going to be in chapters 3, 4, 5, and 8. Don't worry, you don't have to walk around unless you want to. But will you stand as we consider what he has to say about justice? We're going to start in Ecclesiastes 3. We're going to start in verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? And then chapter 5, starting in verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. And then finally in chapter 8, starting in verse 10. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. Now there is a vanity that takes place on the earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. And I commend joy, for man has no good thing under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. This is the troubling word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. So, we're glad that we're no longer in an election season, but there was a time, there's inevitably a time in an election season where some candidate is up there giving this massive speech on the dais with this massive crowd behind him at a political rally, but somehow one of his, shall we say, protesters has found a way to get strategically on that dais behind him so that he's within shot of camera. And as this candidate gives his or her, bloviating political speech, the guy strategically placed behind him suddenly, or subtly starts to unzip his members only jacket and pulls open his coat, and there his t-shirt says, "It's not that simple." To say to all of these politicians, to say to the watching world, yeah, he or she may say what they do, but you know what? It's never that simple. Guess what the preacher is? He's that guy. He's that guy at the political rally shouting, "Oh, justice for all!" And he's the guy unzipping his members only jacket to say, "It ain't that simple." And the quicker you get that, the quicker that there actually might be the hope for something that we might live in. So what he's offering to us is that grating feeling, that unpleasant feeling, that thing that we've talked about called dissonance. Why? What constitutes the dissonance? Well, first of all, he tells us, in a world where everybody wants fairness, what do you got? You got the prevalence of injustice, and that prevalence is simply mind-boggling. He said there in chapter 4, verse 6, "Moreover, I saw under the sun oppressions that are done, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them." We all assume that justice is just going to bubble to the surface like an inflated balloon beneath the water. But he is trying to tell us on the contrary. It's more like there is a lead weight holding that balloon, and it's dragging it deeper and deeper and deeper underneath the surface. Several weeks ago, I introduced you to a guy named Brian Stevenson. He's the guy that said, each one is more than the worst thing that they've done. Remember him? He's written a book called Just Mercy. He's been in the legal profession for about 30 years. I almost finished his book on just mercy while we were on vacation. And he is there to tell you, if you think justice just naturally happens, you are as naive and dangerous to its outbreak as you ever could be. It doesn't just happen. Truth doesn't just out. People are wicked. Systems will institutionalize error. There are self-serving forces aplenty at work, and those self-serving forces actually thwart justice. That's what he's lived. That's what he's declared. And you know what the preacher is saying? Listen to him. Because what he says, it's how it's always been. There's nothing new under the sun. Everybody wants fairness, just like C.S. Lewis says. But the prevalence of injustice, it'll boggle your mind. That's the first thing. That's the first aspect of this dissonance. The second aspect is this. That's not just random. It's not just an unfortunate circumstance or cascade of events. Injustice is baked into the system. When he says in chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, "If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed. Don't be amazed, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them." What's he saying? Justice is subverted because there are people who benefit from its subversion. In the world he's talking about, he's referencing how oppression persists because at every level of power, somebody wants to get their piece of the pie. And in order for them all to preserve their piece of the pie, somebody at the bottom rung of the ladder has got to have to get no pie. And therefore, some get no pie because everybody else wants to keep their piece of the pie. It's baked into the system. If you want to talk about a more modern example, all you got to listen to is Brian Stevenson's account of how judges get elected in this country in many places. What do people in America want? What do people everywhere want? They want to feel safe. And who do they typically look to preserve their safety? Law enforcement and the judiciary. And guess what? Law enforcement and the judiciary, in large part, are elected officials. And so what is the primary plank of every judge's platform? That he'll be tough on crime. You will never hear a political commercial for a judge who ever says of himself, "Oh, he's nuanced. Oh, yes, he's very compassionate about offenders." He says that, there is no job for him. Good luck with that, dude. Enjoy being a paralegal. And so what happens around election time? If a case comes up in which he has an opportunity to be tough, or he risks what happens if he's lenient and that guy gets out and commits another crime, what's he going to do? He's going to err on the side of toughness, because that's how he's going to keep his job, because that's how he's going to benefit. And you think that doesn't happen, brothers and sisters? Read Just Mercy. Not everywhere, but enough of places for it to matter. It's baked in. And the preacher knew that. And you ought to, and I ought to also. That's why it's dissonant. That's why we should be concerned. There's a third reason, though, why there's a little bit of dissonance when it comes to talking about injustice. There are some who are undeterred by the application of the law. He said, in some places, because justice is not exacted speedily, there is no deterrent against breaking the law. And at first you think, wait a minute, is he talking out of both sides of his mouth here? Didn't he just say that there are some people who are wicked that are treated like the righteous, but now he's talking about some who are also wicked, who are getting off scot-free? What, is there a contradiction in his mind there? On the contrary, he's just talking about the same principle, but variously applied to a different constituency. So, for instance, you've probably heard it said that the number of people in American prisons will boggle the mind. But if you wanted to count up the number of corporate CEOs who are guilty of massive fraud, and the number of them either being prosecuted or serving time, you could count them on maybe two hands. So yeah, preacher's right. Not only is it baked into the system, it actually disfavors some and favors others. And what adds insult to injury is that those who are caught in the jaws of oppression, he says in chapter 4, there is no consolation for them. I already read it, but I'll read it again. I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was no one to comfort them. Now, I know this sounds like a Frontline special on PBS, because it is. But injustice persists, brothers and sisters, for lots of reasons. And one significant reason why it does is that a lot of us turn our blind eye to its existence and to its prevalence. So, sidebar. Kids, listen up. I'm not your mommy and daddy, so I'm not telling you to do something that they wouldn't want you to do. And I'm not God, so I don't know about God's call in your life. But if you grow up and you start to think, I might want to be a lawyer and I want to defend justice, you know what? I'll be the first person to write the recommendation for law school. I will. I'll do that. God calls you to that. That's a noble cause, because justice don't just happen. God employs people like Bryan Stevenson and others and countless others to effect it. Because they feel the dissonance, they feel the unpleasantness, and they can't help but try to respond. Now, that's where the preacher goes. That's where the dissonance he explores. But what does he do then? He does what we all do when we're feeling unpleasant because we have conflicting thoughts or we hear F and F sharp. We want it to resolve. So we want to lessen that unpleasantness. And the preacher goes there. And he goes there in three different ways. And therefore, when it comes to you feeling dissonant about injustice, you have a few options that he outlines for you here. The first one is to be totally resigned to it. Just sort of say, you know what? This is the way it is. And for us to fight back, you can, but to what end? It ain't going to happen. It ain't going to change. And that's why he says, it is better both that, let me back up in verse 2 of chapter 4. I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. It's better be dead, he says. It's better not even to have existed than to suffer both the oppression that exists and the inability to even be consoled in the midst of that oppression. He's playing the stinks to be them card. Nothing's going to help. And therefore, the only thing you can do is just sort of resign yourself to it and move on. That's one way to lessen the dissonance. That's one way he offers. But it's not the only way. He says, another way you might want to lessen is you want to maybe find some sort of deeper meaning, more profound truth at the appearance of injustice. And so he said up in chapter 3, verse 18, I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. He's wondering if the whole experience of injustice is out to sort of take us down a notch, that maybe we humans are too high on ourselves. Maybe we think ourselves too important. And maybe the whole experience of being treated unfairly is to show us, you know what? You're no better than my dog. He gets all philosophical because he has the luxury of doing that. He has the luxury of being able to entertain those sort of high-minded thoughts that, you know what, perhaps there is some deeper meaning in the presence of injustice. And you know what, that's all nice and well until you're the one caught in the jaws of oppression. And then for you to even entertain the idea of a deeper meaning, you can try to lessen the dissonance there, but good luck with that. And that's why the preacher also outlines a third way. A way that will sound familiar to you because you've heard it in other passages thus far. Yes, you can resign yourself to the presence of injustice. Yes, you can try to find some deeper meaning in the presence of injustice. Or, you know what? You can just sort of make the most of your life. You can rage against things, resign yourself against things, find meaning in your sins, or just find what good you can. And that's why he says on two different occasions, in chapter 3, verse 22, so I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? I command joy, he says in chapter 8, verse 15. Everything's absurd. Nothing's going to compensate for the absurdity of all things. So get what you can, because this is as good as it gets. And that may be the most jaundiced part of the sermon that we've heard so far. But if you can really do nothing about the presence of injustice, then all of your hand-wringing, you know what that is? That's just hand-wringing. What good is hand-wringing if it leads to nothing else? Now, that sounds like appalling cynicism, right? Like, why are we listening to this? Like, why is the pastor letting this guy's voice bubble to the surface? Because this sure sounds like he's backing off of any idea of injustice. And so the people like Brian Stevenson, he might just sort of chuckle. But he's not done. There's something else he's at work in. And so before you and I might want to heap our inner scowl upon him, did you notice that in chapter 3, verse 17, he says, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. What? You've been cynical for most of this time. Suddenly you're starting to say that maybe God will judge. I thought you were resigned to the presence of injustice, that it's better that maybe we all just learn how to suffer because we're no better than beasts. He goes there. What's he doing? Why is he appealing to this transcendent order? Why is he even countenancing the idea that maybe God actually might ensure that justice lives on the earth? He has looked into the heart of his dissonance, and he is trying to lessen that dissonance in his own self. But when he says in verse 15, 17, God will judge, the preacher of Ecclesiastes has done a third thing for us. He has, as I said at the beginning, opened a space, created a possibility that might actually lead to a resolution of the dissonance. All right. You're all going, oh Lord, will the pastor please come out of the ether for just a moment? What does he mean by that? I'm going to put it in the most concrete terms that I think you like this story. You know, we just got a diabetes alert dog for our son who has type 1 diabetes. You may have also heard that my wife had multiple opportunities to kind of talk with the couple that runs the organization, spiritual conversations, and she didn't bring it up. I mean, she obviously identified herself as a Christian. They identified themselves as lapsed Christians and said, nope, we're at best maybe universalists, but they wanted to talk about it. And in the course of their conversation, they told my wife a story about a friend of theirs who was an outspoken, vehement atheist, was staunchly out to defend his atheism. But you know what happened in the process of him being so resolved, so vehement about defending the tenets of atheism? Something broke open for him in the midst of that defense. that made him entertain the possibility that maybe he was wrong. And you know what happened? He came to conclude that he was. And in the course of that staunch fist-raising, it turned into an open hand that said unto the Lord Jesus, "Come, I yield." Something broke open. In his effort in one direction, he unwittingly, unknowingly created a space for something else to happen. Something quite different. We're not talking about the preacher of Ecclesiastes here getting converted, but we are talking about things that he says that create a space that don't just probe the dissonance, that don't just try to lessen it in order to reduce his own unpleasantness, but actually imagine ways in which that dissonance might be resolved. What am I talking about? When he says that maybe God will judge, he's saying that given who God is, divine justice is not off the table. Despite at other times talking about the prevalence of injustice. And so in chapter 8, verse 12, he says, "Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him." What? Who God is means that justice can come and that we ought to live in reverential fear of that justice. He is saying, he's opening a little space. He's noticing a little crack in his own cynicism, which is echoed even earlier in 3:21. "Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth?" Who knows, he says. It's possible. He can neither confirm nor deny that there is something more to our humanity, that it might even persist even after we die. And so he's actually intimating the possibility that justice is not constrained by the limit of your physical life. Now, he's pretty sheepish about that. It's as subtle as he comes. He's not going to put that as a main plank in his platform, but he's open to it. Justice is not constrained, he is suggesting, by what happens even in the life that we know of. That the presence of justice is not limited by what happens in this life. Now, those are very subtle comments on his part. He doesn't elaborate on them. He doesn't make insistent upon them. They're subtle, they're diffident, they're uncommitted, but they're opening a space. And you know what they're opening a space for? They're opening a space for Jesus to step into and fill. Jesus might listen to those few subtle comments from the preacher and say to him and to us, "Oh, preacher, you don't know how right you are." Because when the preacher asks, "Who knows whether the Spirit goes upward into heaven?" Jesus says, "I know. I do." When the preacher says, "Who can bring man to see what will happen after him?" Jesus says, "I can. I have. I have shown them. I will show them again with power." How can we be so confident that Jesus can respond in those ways? Because when the preacher probes the dissonance, you know what he's doing? He's actually prophesying its resolution. He's actually anticipating its resolution. Remember what he says in chapter 8, verse 14. "There is vanity that takes place on the earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous." That, he says, is an absurdity. That is something that can never be reconciled. That is something that will never make sense. That is totally absurd, and he is absolutely right, unless that absurd experience has a greater purpose. When Jesus steps into absurd experiences, something happens. Because you know what Paul said of him? "For our sake, he made him to be sin, who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God." You know what that sounds like? It sounds like the righteous one that's being treated according to the deeds of the wicked. You know what that sounds like? It sounds like we who are sinners for whom Christ died being treated according to the deeds of the righteous. the preacher has opened up a space for Jesus to step in and say, I'm your Huckleberry. I'm in. I'm that guy. You just didn't know it. And therefore, in putting his finger on the dissonance, the preacher is actually anticipating its resolution. And that sounds nice, and that sounds noble. And that sounds like, well, of course he has to say that. He always has to preach the gospel. That's the gospel, brothers and sisters. What difference does it make to you today? It makes a difference in two ways. For one, it matters with how you and I even think about the experience of injustice, how you and I even endure injustice. If you will contrast the way Protestant churches and Roman Catholic churches display the cross, you probably have noticed that in Protestant churches, if you ever see a cross, you know what it is? It's empty. But when you walk into a Roman Catholic communion and you see the cross, what do you see? You see Jesus on that cross. And you might think to yourself, if you're a Protestant, why do they do that? He's not dead anymore. He's not hanging on the cross anymore. He rose. Why do our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters do that? Why do they leave him on the cross in a display of his crucifixion? J. Lewis Martin is a theologian who said this, "The resurrection of the Son does not eclipse the Son's cross." Far be it from you and I to ever think of the empty tomb as somehow meant to paper over the passion of Jesus. It's only meant to validate that passion. It's only meant to help us to see it in even deeper, thicker, broader relief. Why doesn't the resurrection eclipse the cross? Because it matters, brothers and sisters, not just that Jesus died, but how he died. You ever think about why didn't God just make sure that Jesus died in his sleep? You ever wonder why God just didn't sort of make it quick and let Jesus be beheaded, but allowed him to suffer as he did on a cruel, cursed cross? Why the crucifixion, brothers and sisters? I'm getting a lot of help from Fleming Rutledge in her book on the crucifixion, which I commend to you heartily. It's my Lenten goal to read through that book. But what she reminds us of is this. By the cross, Jesus reconciles us to God and satisfies God's justice. And Jesus does all that by entering into profoundly egregious injustice. And when we see that, when we understand that, when we understand that Jesus enters into massive, incalculable injustice in order to secure justice, then we must understand that no less than God knows what it is to suffer utter oppression, abandonment, and injustice. He takes that up into himself. He doesn't put it at arm's reach. He doesn't say that is for others to endure. He says, I will do that, and I will do that for you. And there is something about knowing that God endures injustice to secure it that does something for us in our own endurance with injustice. It doesn't mean that we don't think it hurts. It doesn't mean we try to put a brave face on it or just sort of say, yeah, this is fun. I'm glad I'm doing this. You don't ever have to sort of revel in the experience of injustice. But it does mean that there is a kind of consolation in it. The space that the preacher opens up for Jesus to walk into is to allow us to discover a strength to be able to endure injustice should it ever come our way. Can you see how committed to justice God is? When you see that, it is not only for the sake of you being able to endure injustice, it is also for you and I to see that what it means to follow Jesus is to pursue justice. And there's a lot of ways you can, and there's a lot of domains in which justice is at work. But where we started the sermon was about a pastor and a journalist talking about justice needing to find its way into a system, into a people. But that's not the only place in which justice plays out. And so I'm going to end this sermon with a story about justice in a vastly different territory. Catherine Drexel is a story I read about this last week. She was a 19th century woman, born into a very wealthy philanthropic family in Philadelphia. Her dad was a banking magnate. Both their father and their stepmother died within weeks of each other, leaving Catherine Drexel with untold millions in inheritance. And she's right around her 20s in that moment, and she's wondering, what do I do? I am well furnished. I could end up doing nothing for the rest of my life, and it would be okay. And so she writes to her spiritual director in Omaha, Nebraska, and asks, what do I do with my life? And in the course of that conversation, she comes to be inspired by something she read from the book of Ecclesiastes. She wrote this. This is what I have found to be true. It is like I have a doll. I have ripped both the doll and the drum open, and the fact lies plainly and in all its glaring reality before me, that all, there is no exception, is passing away and will pass away. I am disgusted with the world. God, in His mercy, has opened my eyes to the fact of vanity of vanities. And as He has made me see the vile, stark emptiness of this earth, I look to Him, the God of love and hope. It's Ecclesiastes that awakens her to the fact that we give ourselves to so many things that are utterly absurd. And it is those same words that inspires her to continue the philanthropic work of her family, such that she even becomes a missionary to Native Americans and to the black community of Tennessee. And in 1905, she and her religious order make a small purchase of property in the hopes of building a school for black girls. They buy the property, they begin the building, and then the previous owner of the land catches wind of what they're about to do. And he tries to rescind the sale. And he appeals to the city council to overturn it. And then he tries to pay off the sisters that they might do something else somewhere else, because he says, you know what's going to happen to our property values, right? What does Catherine Drexel do? She writes him a letter. She promises that the students will be orderly. She reminds this man that there are already black families living in this neighborhood in Nashville. And then she says this, I can fully realize, I think, how you feel about your old revered home, around which so many attachments of the past, the sweet relations of home life hover. I acknowledge I feel the same with regard to mine, and confess that some time ago, when passing it in the trolley cars, when I saw a bill of sale on it, a whole crowd of fond recollections of father, mother, sisters, etc., came vividly to my imagination. And then I more than ever realized how all things temporal pass away, and that there is but one home, strictly speaking, that eternal home where we all hope to meet our own, and where there will be no separation anymore. And so temporal things, after all, are only to be valued inasmuch as they bring us and many others, as many as possible, to the same eternal joy for which we are all created. That'll preach. It's not about economics, brothers and sisters. It's not about race. It's not about education. You know what that's about? That's about justice. And not justice based on some nebulous affirmation of human dignity that people like to trot out but can't ground in anything more than their own desire for it. This appeal to justice is an appeal to one's dignity that's grounded in the glory of God and the immortality of the soul. That's about justice. Justice is about securing what is right and proper for those created in the image of God. And wherever you and I see justice being thwarted, you know what our mandate is? To go after it and seek it, insofar as we're able. You may fail at that. Your words may be frustrated. You may die trying. But you are no fool to follow in the steps of the one who entered into injustice to satisfy the justice of God for you, and then inspire you to seek justice in this world. That's our calling. That's our privilege. And as surely as God has set eternity in our hearts, which you heard from our assistant pastor last week, He has set justice in our hearts too. C.S. Lewis ain't telling you no lie. And in Jesus, we have no better resource than for both enduring injustice and for seeing to its spread. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.